From the Sky News Centre at 5, Gordon Brown's dismissed criticism of defence spending as the bodies of five dead soldiers are returned from Afghanistan. They're among nine service personnel killed in as many days. The Prime Minister says British troops face a very hard summer in Afghanistan, but not denies claims they're not properly equipped. Jed Whiteside's the father of Trooper Christopher Whiteside of the Light Dragoons, who was killed on Tuesday.
He wanted to be part of it. That was his goal, that was his future. That's what he wanted to do. And I suppose at the end of it all, he's paid the ultimate. He's loved it and died for it.
The Metropolitan Police have launched an investigation into allegations of torture made by Binyam Mohammed. The former Guantanamo detainee and British resident claims he was beaten at the detention camp and British MI5 agents colluded in the alleged mistreatment. Talks to avert a possible summer of strikes at troubled British Airways seem to be making some progress. Cabin crew have offered to take a 2.5% pay cut and a salary freeze for the next 18 months to help achieve millions of pounds in savings. Cricket, Australia have taken control of the first Ashes test at Cardiff. Guy Swindles is there.
With the covers on and the rain coming down, singing now the order of the day in Cardiff, and that's probably good news for England, who were in danger of being put to the sword as Australia racked up 463 for 4, a lead of 28 with 6 wickets in hand, when the rain finally put England out of their misery in this opening Ashes test match. Guy Swindles, Cardiff.
Firefighters tackling a blaze in a bustling area of central London say it is now under control. 50 people had to be evacuated from the four-storey office building in Dean Street in Soho. Nearly 2,000 people in Ireland have signed a petition to prevent a tree stump from being removed from a church. It apparently looks like the Virgin Mary. Candles and rosary beads have been draped over it. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Keeling.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week we have Gloucestershire organic food and environmental campaigner Tracy Worcester. Our regular Old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories and then moving on in the second half of the show to look at animal husbandry. What are the standards that determine how well animals have been reared and how good is the quality of the meat in our supermarkets? But before that, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, around 16 degrees to 19 degrees Celsius, fairly cloudy, patchy sun on Saturday, and also a bit of rain on Saturday, that's tomorrow too. Temperatures average around 16 degrees Celsius next week, patchy sun with some rain on Wednesday, maybe. Next weekend, it's the 18th and 19th of July. It looks like it's going to be a little better. Average around 17 degrees Celsius, though. Fairly sunny on Saturday. Patchy sun with a little bit of rain on Sunday and getting windier, too. And the week after next, average temperatures around 16 degrees, getting warmer later in the week. Fairly sunny with Thursday and Friday, week after next, full-on sunshine. OK, so let's have a look at this week's news. And I'm joined, first of all, by Tracy Worcester. Now, Tracy, you are the Marchioness of Worcester. Tell us what that means.
That means that I married somebody who's a Marquess.
Okay, and you're part of one of the biggest landowning families in Gloucestershire. Now, I had a little look on the internet and found that the family has 52,000 acres. That's quite a lot out of the whole of Gloucestershire, something like 10% of Gloucestershire. What does that actually mean, practically?
That means that you still have a feudal system there, frankly. But which would you prefer, to be owned by a supermarket and dictated by somebody who's never there and who the people who work there never see who they're employed by, or you have a family that lives in the house and that runs the farm and that everybody sees and he's accountable to their well-being and he makes damn sure that the houses in the village are a lot cheaper for them to live in than most of the houses that you'll find in quaint Gloucestershire villages where wealthy people go and they commute to the towns and the cities.
Now, you yourself are an environmental campaigner and now also a filmmaker. Why have you gone down that road to filmmaking?
Because I realised that the best way to get your message across is through the medium that everybody seems to be in love with. I have to say I don't share that love affair, but that's the television. And therefore I decided to, not being the Marchioness of Worcester, be doing public speaking, but to have the people who are actually suffering by being pushed off the land by super multinational giants that are combing the globe and undermining farming people all over the world. And it actually is undermining our food quality and our health.
So how have you found your dealings with the broadcasters through film? I imagine that I know your film has been shown on, I think it's More4 as well, and the BBC. How have you found dealing with the broadcasters?
Well, I've been extremely lucky because I made a very radical film, which I thought would be used with the environmental movement to promote their work. It's looking at the root cause of the destruction of the rural economy and the poor quality of our food and the solutions. To my amazement, Channel 4 wanted to take it and they broadcast it on More4. But to get there, we had to go through legal hurdles that I did not exist, knew it no existed. So what we're looking at is the UK has the most big business friendly libel laws in the world. And in fact, there's something called libel tourism, which means that any big business that wants to take some publisher to court, they only have to come to England and they'll more than likely win because they can afford lawyers 24/7. So Channel 4 has fought for a year to ensure that this film is completely belt and braces, squeaky legal, and they put it out despite numerous threatening letters from Smithfield Foods of America, which is the biggest pig production company in the world and who actually suppresses the truth by threatening libel cases to anybody who dares mention their name in a negative light.
Well, that's not the last we'll be hearing about this, because we'll be talking about your film Pig Business a little bit later on in the programme. Now, on to you, Martin. Martin, you were at the Birmingham Central Mosque last weekend. Can you just tell us about that? Because, we were talking about the BBC Conspiracy Files programme that you were on this time last week. How did it go up at Birmingham Central Mosque?
Well, we had a meeting to, if you like, put our case that wasn't put in the BBC's programme. We filmed the show, and it's up on the internet. If you Google Conspiracy Files Birmingham Central Mosque, you'll find about an hour long video of the meeting that we had in the mosque there.
So I know you felt that a lot of the stuff that you told Tristan Quinn, the producer of that Conspiracy Files programme, was never actually used in the broadcast, was it?
No, and it was obviously we expected that the BBC would distort what we wanted to say, and of course we went to Birmingham Central Mosque to put the record straight from our point of view. Most of the material that I gave Tristan Quinn, who was the maker of that Conspiracy Files programme, he didn't use. So this is the modern age. We can make our own film and stick it up there, and it will compete with the BBC's film.
Okay, right. Well, let's start off by looking at some of this week's stories. We're starting off with a story from Australia in yesterday's broadsheet papers. Bundanoon is a little town in New South Wales, and it's thought to be the first in the world to ban bottled water. What's happening is that this company called Norlex Holdings from Sydney are taking the water from underneath this little town, shipping it off to Sydney, bottling it, and then selling it back to the people in the town. And they've decided finally they want to ban bottled water from their town. Now, well, what do you think of that, either of you? Martin.
Well, the reason is what's most important, and that is that a company has come in and is depriving the local people of the water. It's a little bit like Coca-Cola in India, mm-hmm. that is basically taking local people's water and making Coca-Cola and distributing it in the city and making a fortune. So what we've got to realise is that we need to have local production of water as well as food, and so you get your own production from local, and you don't just exploit other people's resources to make money.
Well, I mean, it's pretty ridiculous, isn't it, to you know, use plastic bottles to fill with water and then transport them from one side of the country to the other. It's clearly an irrational way to proceed. You know, we've got to get back to a much more simple life than buying bottled water that's been trucked halfway across the planet. It's just ridiculous.
Now, it occurs to me that there's a sort of little resonance of this here in Bristol, because I know that St John's Conduit, which was put into the city centre by the monks back about 700 years ago, and it was functioning fine for about 700 years, this conduit, which goes from the top of Park Street right the way down and ends up next to St John's Church, next door to the old Magistrates Court. And our local company, Bristol Water, which has been doing all sorts of works underground, that conduit has actually stopped for the first time for 700 years because of their work. And we were told that when all the work was finished, the conduit would be back there again. Because it's one of these little things that sort of gurgles out and people kind of walk past it without noticing. But that stopped around about 18 months ago and it hasn't started since. So there's a sort of, I think, a little echo of that story from Australia happening right here under our noses. And maybe over the next couple of weeks, I'll see if I can find out from Bristol Water whether they're going to actually restore the conduit after 700 years that they've taken out. Anyway, moving on to Argentina's banks say they will shut today, that's Friday, as a measure of to stop swine flu. That sounds a little bit peculiar. What do you think of that, Martin?
Well, I mean, this swine flu epidemic seems to be happening, sort of. We're not panicking as much as we were 6 months ago. We get used to everything in the end, don't we? Obviously, it's a problem, but I'm not a medical person, so I haven't got a lot to say about it, really.
Tracy?
I think that most healthy people would say, well, what's going to happen to me? And then they realise that actually they've got a mother or father who's old and who could get it and could possibly die, or they have a young child, or their daughter has a young child and could possibly die, or are they sick, or are they themselves going on to chemotherapy? I mean, all of us are threatened in some capacity as a loved one might get this disease, which has come from cramming animals into a shed. Why are we cramming these animals into a shed? Apparently, in Denmark, they're not even making money, these big farms. In other words, small-scale, local production of our food is the only way to feed the people on the planet. It's equitable, it's friendly for the animals outside, they can roam freely, and what is most important is their feces is used by the land sustainably and gives nutrients to the soil so that we can survive eating the products from the land. The moment you shove tens of thousands of animals in a shed, what are you going to do with the feces? And that's the biggest problem we've got actually all over the world where these big factories come, including England, where not only the people who work in these factories are suffocating from the ammonia and the hydrogen sulfide, their lungs are damaged, but the people who live anywhere near these farms, because they spread the feces on a very, very small area of land, the stench from the biodegrading feces is making people that live near suffer from respiratory diseases and neurological diseases, and the symptoms of which are sore eyes, swelled eyes, running noses, headaches, feeling faint and dizzy, poor memory. We have a serious problem with the corporate takeover of agriculture. And the only way it seems that we can stop it, because we don't live in a democracy, our government takes absolutely no notice of the situation, doesn't actually pay attention to this huge problem of these massive factories, and it's got to be us. We've got to go to our local farmers' market, or even if we have to go to the supermarket, to buy products which have been produced by farmers whose animals are outside.
Now, I can see the links between swine flu and what you're saying, but the thing is, at the moment, we're hitting a recession. There's many people out there who just simply don't have the money to start spending more on their food. They have less to spend on their food.
I quite understand that situation. What we're looking at in this country is an enormous amount of people who are dying of cancer because they're actually eating too much meat. You also have quite a serious problem in this country where people's diets are not balanced, and they're seeing beyond their control very often that they're getting larger and larger weights on those scales. And what we've got to look at perhaps is eating less meat. And it's just a Western culture that we seem to think that we have to have meat, breakfast, lunch and dinner. Now, if we cut down on the meat and we looked at alternatives, the alternatives are far healthier and far cheaper. And so therefore, let's get a more balanced diet. So that pork that we do buy, let's spread it further. And let's make that healthy food. And if we eradicate our farmers, we're actually eradicating jobs in the countryside.
So how many meals a week are we allowed to have with meat in then?
Well, I don't want to dictate, but I would ideally say the fewer the better. So let's get looking at what sort of recipes there are which have less meat in them and are equally, if not more delicious, and certainly healthier.
Martin, what do you know about the history of this, about the history of our eating habits in Britain?
What do I know about the history of it?
The history of our eating habits, how much meat we have eaten, maybe even, you know, back to medieval times. I don't know.
Well, I mean, your average medieval peasant after the Black Death, when there was a reduction in the population, probably had a healthier diet than people do today, and they did eat meat, but like once a week. The wealthy classes actually had a very unhealthy diet. It was meat and sweeties and wine, and that's all they ate, and of course they all got terribly ill. So a balanced diet does have some meat in it, but not a lot. And in fact, you know, the average medieval peasant at one stage was actually probably eating better than we do today. But at other phases in history, of course, people starved because there wasn't enough to eat.
But before we finish with this Argentina bank story, what do you think of this whole idea of, well, shutting schools, shutting places where people meet because of the swine flu? Is it really that serious?
Well, I'm not a medical person. I don't really know. I mean, if you think about the flu pandemic in 1918, it killed more people in 1 year than the whole of the war had done in 4 years. This doesn't look as bad as that. The fatality rate is, the people are dying, but it's not a huge fatality rate. It's probably about 1 in 100 people or something like that is dying of this. Of course, it's not very nice, but you know, we are actually in a dynamic balance with the environment. I mean, people have always died. Illness will always come back. We're never going to conquer things like flu. They mutate and change, and we just have to adapt ourselves as best we can. I can't see that you're going to prevent it spreading by closing everything down. I think many of us probably are going to get it, but most people won't die. They will just have a bad bout of flu.
And then, of course, once they've caught it, they'll be resistant. So, I mean, is there really any point in trying not to catch it?
I think the really frightening thing is when it comes back and it's mutated into something which is far more virulent and that has a far greater impact on the health of the people who actually get it. So without being a medic and without actually hearing this analysed by our scientists and put onto the radio waves or whatever, is it going to affect more people when it mutates? And therefore, we really seriously have to stop this factory farm system right now, because the bird flu and the swine flu, don't tell me they don't come from the swine farms. They do. And it's all of those appallingly bad habits that they have, where they have many, many animals that die. And when I did my investigation around the farms, I found many rotting corpses covered in flies, people in the towns and villages in America and in Poland say that the flies around their houses are fast. These things, they're mutating into something that we don't know what's going to happen. So don't let's produce this type of food.
If I remember rightly, actually the farm where it's believed to have started in Mexico was actually owned by a big American...
Smithfield.
Was it really the same company?
Yeah, well, my film is about Smithfield.
Really? Gosh. Okay, well, we'll be hearing a bit more about that later on. Anyway, let's move on to the next news story from this week. Nick Clegg, a leader of the Liberal Democrats, has said the lives of British soldiers in Afghanistan are being thrown away. Martin, can we come to you? Is this the first time, I think, that we've had the consensus for the basically for the war in Afghanistan being broken by Nick Clegg? I mean, he's blaming the government, but it's quite an extreme statement to say that lives are being thrown away.
Well, all opinion polls show that about 60 to 70% of the British people do not want to fight in Afghanistan and never did. The political classes and the media talk about it as if it's all absolutely agreed that it's a jolly good thing for us to be there, but I can't see that many ordinary families in Britain can see the point of British soldiers dying in Afghanistan. For what?
Yeah, well, so what are they saying is the reason to be there?
Well, it's very good. It keeps mutating, doesn't it? We were supposedly storming in there to capture Al-Qaeda bases, I seem to remember, in 2001. Then it was to stop women having to wear the burqa. And I saw that in the Palang Valley last week, the British Army arrived to win hearts and minds, except that everybody had run away. So they just marched around a bit, got a few people blown up and sniped at, and then they got into their helicopters and went home.
Well, they're not going to win...
People came out of the caves and carried on with their lives.
They're not going to win hearts and minds like that, are they?
No, well, they've got to find the people to win the hearts and minds first. I mean, of course... It doesn't. The US are carrying out random airstrikes which kill hundreds of people. So, we're hearing about British soldiers dying in Afghanistan. Boo hoo! But civilians are dying all the time. Poor people. We don't bother to count them, do we?
No, I don't know. There have also been some. There's also been another spate of atrocities the last couple of days in Iraq as well. But sticking with Afghanistan, Tracy, what's your views on Afghanistan?
I simply cannot understand why we are in Afghanistan. Frankly, it at one point I thought it was because there was a pipeline going through Afghanistan that the American government wanted to protect, and the Taliban did not come along with their terms. You then get Stooge Blair doing everything that Bush wants because he wants to be in bed with the right person to make sure that he's the one who gets the backhanders with the deals to rebuild these countries once you've demolished them. I think that basically we're being led by people who are completely unconnected to the views and the wills of the people. We don't have democracy, and yet we charge into these countries saying we're going to bring them democracy. We're going to free them from what? What do we know about Afghan life? What do we know about Afghan history? It's time we mind our own business and we looked at our own backyard and we saw how many problems we have in this country. Look how we have terrible statistics of our children's well-being, of our, obviously I'm very interested in our environment, but the long-term ability to feed our population, and yet we go dictating rules to other countries of how we're going to develop them down our blueprint. Are we so happy? Are we so wealthy? Are we so good to be able to go into another country and dictate how they're going to lead their lives? Forget it. Get out of that war. Leave them alone.
Isn't the whole idea at the moment, though, that they're trying to prepare for an election in a few weeks' time, and that will be part of the process of actually bringing people power to Afghanistan?
The Taliban have told their people not to participate in the election, and that's what normally happens in situations like that. The Taliban and the Pashtuns probably won't participate in the election as a protest against the whole situation. And ultimately, of course, the Afghans have to solve their own problems their own way. They have to negotiate with each other. And if we intervene, all we're doing is prolonging the situation where they don't talk to each other, because people aren't going to talk as long as the same thing happened in Iraq. The different factions won't talk to each other as long as the foreigners are there backing up one side or the other. And ultimately these people have to solve their own problems in their own way, and obviously we wish them well in solving their problems, but I don't think we're doing any good by charging around blowing things up.
But saying that lives are being thrown away in Afghanistan is almost sounds like a criticism of the you know, the sort of hierarchy of the army, saying that they're actually not fighting this battle with the correct style of tactics.
I seem to remember when we first went in there, John Reid, who was the defence secretary, saying we don't expect to fire any bullets at all, and that the people want us to be there, and it's all going to be fine. It seems to me that from a military point of view, the Taliban have now got their system in place. They're killing 3 to 4 British soldiers a week, and that's how it will go on. It will go on for another 30 years like that, if that's what we want, and it'll still be the same at the end of it. We're still going to lose. There's absolutely no way we're going to win. The question is, at what point, like in Vietnam, do we cut our losses?
What's quite interesting at the moment is the media is full of stories about McNamara, because he's just died.
That's right.
And how he regretted his involvement in the Vietnam War. It seems that we don't learn from our mistakes. So I think that we should be looking at the past and how many times we've tried to go into Afghanistan and conquer because we're greedy. And actually, here we are again, dictating the rules of the game for a nation that we have no idea what they want or how they lead their lives, and we haven't got a platform to speak about anything on those issues, because we are a disaster. Our businesses are bankrupt. Our banks are not lending money, which is maybe a blessing. Maybe we'll see a revitalization of local economies where people lend and barter between each other for their real needs.
Okay, that's the end of the sort of big national stories. We're looking now down at some, zooming in to look at some Bristol stories. One is agenda item 12, apparently, on the Health and Audit Care Committee at Bristol City Council on the 22nd of July. Then subsequently it's going to be on the agenda for Cabinet on the 30th of July's proposal to close 3 elderly people's homes. Social services officers did not produce a paper at the social service agenda meeting, and it will only go public for the meeting on the 22nd. We'll have about 5 days' notice of that. And also, anyone that wishes to read the document can find it on the Bristol City Council's web pages in a few days' time. But that's another, it looks like, 3 more elderly people's homes to close. Martin, can I just get your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, obviously I'm not that familiar with this particular situation, but obviously we need care for people. People need to be looked after. And picking up on what Tracy was saying earlier, we need to be looking after our own people properly, rather than charging around the world trying to impose our values on others. And of course, there's going to be a real problem if the economy continues to slide. They're talking now about cutting public expenditure, which means that all of these very necessary things which are required for the people's welfare will be cut away. And we could end up in a situation like in the United States, where there is no proper welfare state, where there is no healthcare, where when you get old, you can die in the street, and that's all that happens to you.
But I think many people out there would be thinking, well, hang on a minute, we've just shoveled all this money in the direction of the banks. How come we haven't got enough money to keep open 3 old people's homes?
Well, you've just answered your own question. The money's all gone to the banks, and which is scandalous, frankly.
Tracy.
Well, I'm obviously very sorry for the people who want to be in that home, who've settled and who will be disturbed by being moved, and for the families who are very deeply concerned about their relations. But can I just use that as an example? For example, in Afghanistan and a great many countries around the world, including Italy, people look after their own old at home. And I think that there really has to be understanding that perhaps this economic system that we've been championing around the world, where apparently we tax the people and then we look after their old, well, maybe that system simply doesn't work, because actually we're controlled and we're in the grip of multinational corporations who don't pay the nation's taxes. There isn't enough money to look after the people that we've been promised through this capitalism to look after. And so maybe, again, we have to take back control of our lives, and we have to say, our parents looked after us when we were little. We're going to take responsibility of our children and our parents as well. And those parents are no longer going to be the responsibility of the state. We're going to demand that we earn enough money so that we are actually looking and have enough to look after them at home.
But what about many couples, both of whom are working full time just to pay the mortgage? They just simply don't have the resources to look after elderly relatives as well.
Yeah, I completely understand. In that we have a system, and an economic system, where we actually can't afford to have a roof over our head without being in debt for our entire life. As far as I'm concerned, that's slavery. And if we actually can't afford to look after our parents, that is a society that is really in serious trouble.
So what do you see? Is there any kind of light at the end of the tunnel here? If we're heading towards a crisis, as Martin has said, economic crisis and a social crisis, as you're talking about, is that going to be a really painful transition? Or do you think that we've got the wherewithal to have a bit of a sensible and smooth transition to a better world?
I think it's very worrying at the moment that you've really got only two parties that will ever get into power, because we're so dependent on corporate money for those two parties that they have to carry the corporate agenda. But if people were more informed, and maybe through our media like you, where you actually realise that there are ways of living where you can you build your house within your community, you look after your parents within your community, and there's a lot of countries in the world that still have a local economy, and we should be saying that they are going to be teaching us, not us all the time giving more money to so-called develop them, so that we become literally slaves in our own land under the banner of so-called democracy. So I would say that as much as we possibly can to reclaim our lives, to reclaim our employment in as many small-scale ways as possible. And I would like to see a revolution of ideas. And I'm not on my own with this. Robert Kennedy Jr. in America, he's in my film, and he says that we need a revolution today. And it's a peaceful revolution. It's a revolution of ideas. And it's taking back control of our lives away from corporations.
The trouble is that's almost impossible to do when you're fighting and spending every hour, getting through traffic jams, looking after the children, and just simply paying the rent.
I know. We're sort of a bankrupt economy, because economy is about looking after the family. So I think that what we need to do is to look at, when we do have a chance to vote, we look at which party is actually going to enable us to reclaim control over our lives and stop giving control over to the European Union, which is full of more bureaucrats that are controlled by corporate interests.
I think we need to change the political system to a proportional system, and we've had liberal colleagues in here. It's totally unacceptable to have a sort of monopoly of two parties, both of which are in the corporate pocket. I mean, that's where we've ended up. We need to change the game, as they did in New Zealand in the 1980s. We're going to open it up to a proportional system, and then we'll have a selection of
so
different,
what happened,
different ideas.
What happened in New Zealand then? I don't know about that.
What happened in New Zealand is that they got New Labour in 1980 instead of in 1997, and the activists and the unions pretty quickly worked out what was going on. They forced a referendum on PR, and they then brought in a proportional system, which meant that the corporations couldn't control the agenda. What happened was that New Zealand Treasury was captured by the IMF, and they tried to carry out all of this privatisation and so on as an experiment.
How can the IMF capture the Treasury? It sounds like a military.
It's a small country, and I know people who used to work in the Treasury. All they had to do was just get certain people on side, because it's only a small country, and they used them as guinea pigs for all of this privatisation, deregulation, etc. But the people in New Zealand didn't want that. They had a rather regulated system. A system which they'd built up in the 1930s with a strong welfare component, and they weren't happy with it. So the thing about New Zealand is, if they don't like something, they get off their bum and change it.
Well, I suppose
that's what they did.
That's a bit easier with this much smaller country.
It is easier in a smaller country. We have the whole weight of history bearing down on us. You know, House of Lords, City of London, can't do it like that. We've always done it like that. I mean, it's just inertia. But of course, New Zealand, they've got a bit more get up and go.
What about you, Tracy? Do you think proportional representation, changing the voting system, would be a sort of one step towards this better world?
I definitely do. I think it's essential that the number of politicians in government are reflected by the number of people that voted for them. So if you get a Green Party that might have quite a large percentage of the vote, they have absolutely nobody in Parliament because the system is corrupt in the way that it's been designed to actually keep out parties that are representing people and their strong ideas.
Yeah, but you see, we've just seen with the proportional system that's used to elect MEPs at the European Parliament, we've just seen the British National Party triumphantly marching into Brussels. So that's the sort of thing that we can see. Martin, we've had you answering this sort of question a few weeks ago. I want to hear Tracy's answer.
Well, I think that we've got to look at why people are voting for that party. And that is because people are really desperate that more and more power is going away from their own family, community, city, nation. And we should address what they're doing and look at alternative parties like the Green Party, who actually is wanting to protect the family, the region, the nation first, because actually small is beautiful. It's much more representative if you go far nearer the people in their home than you keep on having further and further bureaucracies dictating the rules of the game.
Right, we'll finish off this little section on the local news with a couple of local police stories. A speeding cop has got his job back. The guy's name's Ian Kingston, and he was caught doing 110 miles an hour in a 40 mile an hour limit and fined £2,000. But he's works at the police helicopter up in Filton, and he's just got his job back. Now, do you think that's okay? There's lots of unemployed people out there. Maybe they could have his job.
I don't know. Men will be men. They like to drive fast, and I wish that there was slower limits in our villages and our towns. And this is just one idiot who went mad for I don't know how often he does it. But I think that the problem is that all of us could be controlled in the way that it would be better to go by bike or by public transport. I don't think many people realise quite what a pleasure it is to go by bicycle, how you keep fit, how you're far closer to the other people in the street, the smiles, the laughter, it's more humane.
But it's not really practical, is it? I mean, there are people out there on their way home tonight, and they'll be saying, "Look, there's no way I could do this journey by bicycle."
I wonder how many people would say that, and if they do, then if it's no way, then there's no way. But if there was a bus that was given as an alternative, if there was a local train that was an alternative, if there was a path that wasn't so horrendously noisy and dangerous with lorries and pollution out of the back of the lorry. You've always got to look at what are the causes of the problems. And the cause is that we're encouraged to buy more cars because our economic system depends on it. It's not convenient for us or the well-being or the health of our children.
We need this crisis is an opportunity, if you like, for us to rethink our priorities about things like transport. I can't see in another generation that we're going to be driving cars the way we do now. They'll be used for essential journeys, which other modes of transport can't cover. And we're going to have to move back towards things like, electric trains, trams. All of these, maybe we'll all live and work in smaller communities, as Tracy's suggesting, so we won't commute as much. We need to think about where we want to go and decide how we can plan to get there, rather than just blundering along in the same old way, just doing the same old things. The car industry all over the world has crashed and smashed. It's disappearing. So they're going to have to build something new. That whole era is coming to an end, and we're going to have to start thinking new thoughts and doing things in a different way.
Yeah, but I mean, the bikes and the cars can't really compete with each other, can they? If you're cycling, even if it's only a 2 or 3 mile commute you've got, but many people will think, well, it's just too dangerous on a bicycle. If I'm doing that journey at peak time and rush hour, day after day after day, I'd much rather have that shell of metal around me rather than be sort of wobbling along on my bicycle.
Well, that's why I said that actually the control should be stronger, the person in the car, in that there should be more space for the person on the cycle and the person who's walking, and the bus lane should go faster than the car, so that we're actually discouraged from going in the car as much as possible. And the alternatives, when you discourage, you've got to supply alternatives. So I'm not saying that that person that's stuck in their car now and has no choice, they would have a choice. It's just, what are the priorities of the government? The priorities are big business. It's the market economy. And actually, General Motors went bust in America, and Obama had to take it back. And what he's now saying is that you have to have small cars, hybrid cars, so they're green cars. So this market economy doesn't work now that we realise that we're actually destroying the planet, we're destroying our health.
Isn't maybe the problem that the government raises more, simply that the government raises more tax revenue from the car industry than it does from the bicycle industry?
Well, not anymore, not with the car industry going bust, as Tracy just said. We've ended up being a car-oriented society as a result of corporate pressure. The closure of the railways in the early 60s was a result of the pressure from the motor industry. If we think back to how it was then, we could have kept all of those railway lines, but that was not the way the thinking was going. We will regret making those decisions.
Well, I know the local Greens have been pressing for the reopening of the Portishead line, and that seems to be stalled again and again, but that may be a small move towards that, sort of a little bit more sustainable transport that we were talking about there. Final story, 150 more Avon and Somerset Police are to get taser guns. These are the sort of electric shock guns, which you point and pull the trigger, and they give the victim a 50,000 volt stun. Now, what are your thoughts about that, Martin, to start with you? Are these things actually really useful in fighting crime?
Well, I mean, the way to fight crime is for the police to have good intelligence. And for them to have good intelligence, they must be known to the community, and the community must know them. Charging around tasering people, or as we saw at the G20 protests, police dressed like robocops beating up young women, that is not the way forward for policing. We need to get back to the old style policing, where people actually knew who the policemen were and women, and worked with the community and with the grain of local thinking and local feeling.
But that doesn't really wash when it comes to violent criminals. I mean, the violent criminals aren't going to be the friends
violent
of the police.
Violent criminals have guns, and therefore when the police go out to take them on, they should have guns. Tasers are just for public order type stuff, and the danger is abuse of these kind of weapons. That's the danger, because they are serious. People can be seriously hurt with one of those taser guns.
Well, they have been killed by them, yeah. Taser guns. Anyway, Tracy, what's your thoughts about tasers? Is this a step forward or a step back?
Well, I'm very glad that you weren't going to say that they were given permission to have more guns. That would have been very scary. So, and that's certainly the way that America has gone, and since we followed in their footsteps, I wouldn't be surprised if you'd have said that. But I think that if we're right that the criminal has a gun, I'd much rather that the policeman had a taser gun and that was going to hit him to stop him, one, being shot himself, and two, stop the crime from happening, and the man in the end was okay, so that he could sort out his problems that he's turned to crime in the first place. And I think what we're seeing in our broken society, that we charge into Afghanistan, tell them how to live, is that we're increasing our crime rates, because more and more people are pushed in a society where consuming is the glorious way to be. And if you can't afford to give your children what they want, you can't afford to live the way you want, I think a great many people are pushed into getting what they want. They haven't got the willpower to just say, okay, well, I'll have nothing, because it's not a society of having nothing.
So what about this issue of trust between the police and the community, though? I mean, is this symptomatic of a breakdown of that trust?
I just think that if you've got somebody who's not going to trust you anyway, because he's absolutely damn determined to raid that bank or attack that old woman, you have to have something to stop him. And therefore, the taser seems a better answer than a real gun.
Okay, now let's move on to have a little chat with you, Tracy, about your film. First of all, we talked a little bit right at the very start of the show about how you got into filmmaking. What about this specific film? Can you just explain what the content of it is and how you came to make it?
I came to make it because I've been public speaking for a great many years on the issues of the destruction of our local economies, and particularly the food economy. And so if you are speaking to audiences, really the best way to explain situations is to have the real people who are suffering from either their farm disappearing because the economy is broken, because the supermarkets have come in and they're flooding the market with cheap produce, and the local farmer who's producing far more sustainable food cannot afford to stay in business. So I also saw that the pig industry was, and this particular story was a very good in to show the public the corporate takeover of our food industry, because we all love pigs. Pigs are more intelligent than dogs, and at the moment they're treated like car parts. They are literally on a factory floor. And so to actually deal with animals in that situation, you're seeing an increase in cruelty, because the animal is not something that you can lift up with a machine without it suffering extreme pain. And you then actually see the people who work in those factories are suffering hugely from their health, and the neighbours next door to these factories are also suffering because of the polluted air. And actually the whole economy of the nation is suffering, because if you destroy the rural economy, you're actually destroying the backbone of a contented nation. In America, there are no people who live in the countryside. And in this country, there are very few farmers left. And yet, a great many of us would love to bring our children up in the countryside. We'd love to live in the countryside. We'd like to live in a village with a small community. And we're herded into huge urban connotations where we're expected to find a job, pay a mortgage our entire life, and keep up with the Joneses. And I think that really we're looking at this story as the root cause of the breakdown of our well-being. And it's the most urgent issue is food. We need food 3 times a day. We live on an island. And we know that the supermarkets have 3 or 4 days' supply. What's going to happen if there is a major catastrophe, whether it be a war that we can't get the food into our nation, like during the last war where we swore we'd never be dependent on other nations to feed our nation again, or even something like a pandemic that is really serious and we can't get food to our people? We have to keep the skills on the land to feed us.
Martin, you've been talking over previous weeks about the global economic crisis affecting shipping around the world. I mean, do you think this is a real possibility, as Tracy says, that we may have problems in importing food?
Well, if we think about the way food markets actually work, they're incredibly distorted. The Common Agricultural Policy effectively is a huge distortion mechanism. We haven't got a free market in food. We haven't had a free market in food for donkey's years. So what we're actually doing is just producing for the sake of producing. And my argument would be that if we are going to subsidise food production, which we probably should do, then we should subsidise to produce something sensible instead of just producing mountains of rubbish. All countries need to have a degree of food security. We can't just have a situation where some countries in the world are dependent on food aid, and that's not a very good place for them to be. We need to rebalance the rural economy all over the world. It's only in the last couple of years that the majority of human beings have lived in urban areas for the first time in history. And rural areas all over the world are being depopulated by big business dumping, effectively. I mean, the US subsidises its huge agricultural output and then dumps it on the rest of the world, destroying local farming, destroying local livelihoods. And this is a deliberate policy, because what they want to create is this landless class of people who can be crammed into factories and made to produce and to consume. And we need to rebalance that. We need to give people an option. If they want to go to the city to work, fine. But if they want to stay where they are and have a good quality of life on the land, that should be encouraged and supported. But at the moment, peasant agriculture all over the world is being destroyed in the most stupid and short-sighted fashion. And I certainly saw that in Poland, where you've got lots of small farmers there, and they're being ruined because they are being forced to compete in a completely unfree market, and they're being gradually wiped out. It's just ridiculous.
Well, just to bring this discussion about food back to Bristol for a minute, we're going to hear now from one of Bristol's organic butchers' shops. It's up White Ladies Road, which is doing really good business and bucking the recession.
My name's Nick Rapps. I'm a butcher at Sheep Drove Organic Shop. We basically just, well, full body butchers, so everything that we sell is actually cut in the premises, so, and it all comes from our own farm.
Whereabouts are you?
In Bristol, and the farm is in Lambourne in Berkshire, so it's not very far, which, you know, food miles count to us, so it doesn't...
It's whereabouts in Bristol, though?
Clifton, Redland area, at the top of Blackboy Hill.
Now tell me, what is the difference between buying your food and meat, obviously specifically, in a shop like yours, and going and buying it a bit cheaper in a supermarket? Why on earth has anyone come through your front door?
Well, several reasons. One is that here it's fresh and it's not in a packet, and you can buy as much or as little as you like. Secondly, it's all from the one place. We know where it's sourced. We know where problems lie if they ever occur. Whereas in supermarkets, it can come from anywhere in the world almost, and you know, it's impossible to trace it. Even organics in supermarkets can be a little bit dodgy because you can get things from Australia, so the food miles rack up, and it's all time after kill that it's, you know, for eating, and it can go off quite quickly. So,
well, surely those people, all they do is they'll freeze the meat and preserve it that way. It doesn't actually make any difference in the final quality.
No. Well, quality. Yeah, I mean, freezing. If you want to buy frozen products, then fair enough. But you know, fresh is best. And you know, here we sell our lambs about 5 days after slaughter. Beef is slightly different because you hang beef for at least 5 weeks here to get good aging on it, whereas in supermarkets it's not even a week. It goes from slaughter to butcher's counter within a matter of days. So,
but at the end of the day, it's a grisly business, butchery, and it doesn't really make any difference where you buy your meat. The meat's still being slaughtered, and there's still a certain amount of, even if it's a small bit of cruelty to the animal.
Yeah, it's, the thing is, you know, it's all down to whether your preference and your ethics, to be honest. You know, it's whether or not you want animals coming from, you know, Denmark, being slaughtered over there, brought over here, and things shipped out from over here over to there. It just seems, you know, slightly, the logic of it doesn't match up, to be honest. And it's all, yeah, it's pretty much ethics, to be honest. And
so how are animals reared at your farm?
We rear them organically, which is, you know, free range, and they don't have any barriers. There's no injections for antibiotics or anything like that, unless it's absolutely necessary. And even when you give the animals antibiotics, you leave them alone for 6 weeks so it can go through the system. So it is as if the animal was actually in its natural environment.
Why is it that some farmers are allowed to use all these different chemicals and injections on animals if not using them actually produces a better product at the end of the day?
They're not really worried about better product. They're more worried about units and getting things through, which is, you know, price at the end of the day. Supermarkets want a lower price. They want it quicker. They want it, you know, better, through quicker, basically. And with organics, that's not what it's all about. It's time and effort and, you know, quality rather than quantity.
So. Now, particularly in a recession, we're seeing lots of small butchers, and over the last 10 years or so, lots of small butchers going to the wall. How come you've managed to survive that? And in fact, you're doing reasonably well at the moment, I understand.
Yeah, it's...
When I tried to phone you earlier on, you were doing a massive order. I mean, obviously, Friday's not the best day for butchers, but, you know, you're not about to close tomorrow, are you?
No. It's, you know, it's all down to how you run your shop as well, to be honest. We utilise everything that we get off the animal. We give away bones for stock. We just ask for a charity donation. And we try and help people out as much as they possibly can. If somebody came into our shop and said, we've got £10 to shop with and that's all we can afford, then we will cater for that and we'll do our best. Because it's not always all, you know, with organics, it's not always expensive. It's just knowing the right cuts to buy and what to do with it. So
what about things like game? Is it just the ordinary livestock that you do here, things like chicken, lamb and beef?
Yeah, well, we do everything that comes from our own farm is organic, and any produce that we sell is usually organic, apart from when the game season starts. We got a good game dealer that we get from, which we don't mind selling game because obviously it's closest to organic as you can possibly get without being organic. And it's what organics is all about, getting things into their natural environment and natural state. So, yeah, game season's September to February, and we stock all sorts of poultry and rabbits, venison, everything we can get. But we won't buy it farmed, not at all. So we only ever get it through the season and not during the summer, because it's not... Game season doesn't run through the summer, you see, so, yeah.
Okay, final question. Yeah. What do you know about non-organic methods, and, you know, what is it that is there anything that sort of worries you about the non-organic methods of rearing livestock?
Just the health of the animals, to be honest. I mean, you know, I've only ever worked in organics, so I can't, you know, don't have a huge opinion on it because, like I said, I've only ever worked in organics. But you've seen the programs with the livestock and, you know, the crowding of the animals, and it does affect the final quality because you do get marks in the meat, and the quality does go down.
That was Nick Rapps from Sheep Drove Organic Butchers, just off Black Boy Hill at the top of White Ladies Road. Now, are you familiar with these people? I mean, what do you think, and how are they managing, do you think, to buck the trend, Tracy?
I think that the people who have their small-scale organic farms are like life rafts, because they are the people who are going to be able to supply our food when we see that pandemics like swine flu and bird flu are a serious problem on all of our health. It is a cost that we simply cannot afford. We've got to look at production of food which is natural, and therefore we cannot go on producing food which has got such huge costs to our health, the health of the people who work in these factories. The well-being of the animal is important, but I think that most people realize that their health is paramount. And if you are actually seeing, for example, in the Netherlands, where 40% of the people who work on these pig farms have swine flu. And it's like, no, hang on a minute. It's not swine flu. Oh, God, it's MRSA. That's right. And they're not all dying because they actually don't have a cut or they don't have a health issue. But it's spreading. And we all know what happens in the hospitals in this country, which has got another strain of MRSA, where people who do have a problem are actually suffering and dying from this terrible disease. And so if you have a situation where the animals are crammed into buildings and the bacteria mutates to being resistant to antibiotics, you're then getting things like Campylobacter, or I can't remember all these terrifyingly long names. But anyway, MRSA is the one that sticks in my brain.
But hang on a minute, because we're living in the age of the supermarket. These guys have a virtual monopoly on the way that we get our food. Almost all of us get most of our food from supermarkets.
But it's the supermarkets and the way that they're buying that's encouraging this type of production, because they're not actually paying the true cost. And they're then saying to us that you shop, we drop. In other words, they just push every farmer that's farming sustainably out of business. And they're encouraging these giant factory farms that produce huge quantities of food. But the external costs to people's health down the road is too much for us to pay for the long-term well-being of the population. So we've got to start taking the bull by the horns and saying we're not going to buy that type of meat, because our government does not represent us. There is not a democracy in this country. It's corporate rule.
Okay, well, that's just about all we've got time for this week. Now, we're going to finish off, rather than with our normal theme tune, with a tune from that you've chosen, Tracy. Can you tell us why you've chosen it?
I just think it's one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. And I think that actually music can uplift our spirits when a lot of problems for everybody in this climate of inflation and old people suffering from loneliness in the old age pensioners' homes. You have situations where you don't trust the food that you're giving your children anymore. You have increased crime. You have a lot of problems in our society. So this is uplifting song.
And it's Jackson Browne, Before the Deluge.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.